Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Filthy Lip Out Golf Podcast with me, Kit Alexander, Johnny Morgan. And joining us today, a man who was boots on the ground out there at Whistling Straits for, at the Ryder Cup for Sky Sports, Jamie Weir. Jamie, thanks for coming on. How are you? How's the jet lag?
Yeah, just about recovered, thank you. I got back yesterday around lunchtime, managed to sort of, after a few espressos, keep myself awake until bedtime last night. So I think I'm back at the races today, but still slightly recovering from what was an incredible week. It really was.
Powering through it. I love it. Yeah, what was it like to actually be out there? Obviously, so few Europeans got to experience it. No fans.
Yeah.
Obviously, a few guys like you went out there for the media. How was it as a week?
I mean, it was amazing. I know we'll come on to it. We'll talk about it in greater detail, but obviously not the result we wanted. But just the experience of being there at something that big, to be behind the ropes as well, sort of walking the fairways with some of the wives and families of the players. And just, you know, it was a lovely atmosphere amongst all the European sort of backroom staff. And because there were so few European fans there, we as European media were almost made to feel like part of the team as well. So, you know, when Shane Lowry held that putt on Saturday night, I was hugging other members of the European backroom team. And it was a fantastic experience. Yes, we got an absolute whooping, but we'll get them back in Italy.
Absolutely. That we will, Jamie, that we will. Let's talk about the golf course, mate, because that looked unbelievable, Whistling Straits. I mean, looks like you could get lost in there.
It was absolutely spectacular. I was blown away the second I got there. It was just the whole 8 holes that ran along straight alongside Lake Michigan, spectacular. The sand dunes, the contours, the greens, everywhere was incredible. And TV viewers at home got to see it at its best as well, because the practice days were pretty cold and chilly and overcast and windy as well. And then for the 3 days of the tournament, just the sun shone and the whole place looked spectacular. And there was a lot of talk in the build-up to it about how it was slightly sort of British, Irish, linksy to look at. It didn't play like that. It played like a very American course. But yeah. Testament to Pete Dye's architecture, because it was a spectacular course to look at when you were there in person. But I think on television, it looked pretty incredible as well.
It's because it was on farmland as well. I mean, it's really low level, but they've just built it up and made an absolute masterpiece.
Yeah, I mean, there were some tee boxes I stood on and I just thought, how on earth, if I'd stood on here, how on earth am I finding the fairway here? It just looks like 300 yards of carry over sand dunes and chasms. And yeah, it must have been pretty intimidating on the eye, but for those guys, it's not a problem.
Is it the 8th where you basically can't see any fairway? There's just
hidden landing area. All you can see is all of Lake Michigan to your right, and then just sand dunes everywhere as far as the eye can see. And you sort of, you aim at this little lone bush, which is sort of 280 yards in front of you, and just hope that you can carry that and find the fairway. But I mean, they did, and then some. It's quite incredible to stand behind some of their tee shots and just see the effortless power they have. But it really was a spectacular course. I think it probably looked even better on TV than it did in person.
Yeah.
One thing that got me was you actually almost did get a sense of the elevation changes a bit on TV, which you don't always on golf courses where you know it's there. So if you can see it on TV, that tells you there's some pretty severe slopes. And we saw that incredible shot from Jordan Spieth, the flop shot on the first day when he was sort of down the side of one of those banks. It was only when you got the camera side on, it was like twice the height of him and how high the ball went.
The shot tracing on that is brilliant, isn't it?
The shot. Yeah. I didn't realize it had gone that high. I mean, I know it had gone high until you saw the shot tracer version of it. That was insane.
Yeah, and how he managed to not fall into Lake Michigan was impressive as well.
Right, yeah, John, he put the brakes on just in time.
Yeah, if it had been 6 feet closer, he was getting
right, mate. He was in.
All right, John, you predicted a tie in our preview episode. I went 2 points America. I think a lot of people thought it would be closer than it was in the end, but America were, you know, worthy favourites. What's your reaction to that 19-9 record defeat, John?
Well, I want to say it doesn't do it justice, but it, do you know what? It kind of does. I mean, they played, for what I've seen, because I watched every minute that there was to offer for it, and I just couldn't believe the standard of golf they were playing. From start to finish, I mean, the whole pack, I mean, it was just ridiculous. From what I was seeing, they all had brought their A games. Every one of them, right? One I couldn't say went on form. You know, you could probably pick out, you know, four or five, you know, that weren't quite swinging and all dancing, you know, in our team, you know, full on, you know, full on going for it. But yeah, it's just a shame. I just really was, you know, but I mean, the hype, the anticipation of the Ryder Cup always brings the best out in you. And, you know, everyone's up for it. Just all the punters at home, all of us. And it's just a, you know, it's just a shame we came up shy and a long way shy, unfortunately. But, you know, Italy's another one coming up that will be interesting. I can't wait for that. Got to get our own back, just like Rory said.
Yeah. Jamie, what was the difference on the ground that you saw between the two teams?
I think I said this on TV as well, that it's inevitable there will be criticism of Padraig Harrington because that's just the social media age we live in. Everyone, the finger has to be pointed somewhere. And I know we're going to come on to the qualification process and whether that can be tweaked. There are maybe a few questionable pairings as well. Hand up and say you were outplayed by a better team. And it was almost the perfect storm. I think we just ran into a freight train. We ran into a team of incredibly talented players who were all hitting form at the right time. And unfortunately, the incredibly talented players in our team were kind of coming into the Ryder Cup slightly out of form. And the likes of Tommy Fleetwood, Tyrrell Hatton, Lee Westwood, we know they're fantastic players, but they just didn't have their best game that week. And that's more frustrating for them than it is for any of us. But every single one of that American team are sensational golfers and were playing sensationally that week. And the course suited them perfectly. It was a real ball strikers golf course and their team was just filled with ball strikers. They had the extra distance off the tee than us. The scoring on the par fives shows the massive chasm between the teams. I think, I don't have the stats to hand, but they were something like 42 under for the par fives and we were something like 17 under or something like that. And it's just, that shows the extra distance advantage they have. There was certainly not, there should never be any question marks over the team spirit in the European team. It's one of the most united, motivated European teams I've seen. So comfortable in each other's company. They had a great laugh all week. It was just, like I said, the perfect storm. Everything worked out in the US's favour and everything seemed to go against us. We didn't get the rub of the green, they did. And the scoreline reflected the dominance. What I would say is very few matches were sort of absolute shellackings. There weren't any 5-4s or 6s and 5s out there. Everything sort of got to the 16th or 17th hole. And our boys did their best to sort of cling on gamely and take matches that far. But sometimes, as I said, you just got to hold your hands up and admit you're outplayed by a better side.
Yeah, that's the age we live in. Everyone's looking to analyse and, as you say, blame. But sometimes in sport, you just get beaten by the better team. And I think that happened. And you looked at them on paper. And that was always likely to happen, in fairness. You know, as Europeans, we perform above our station in the Ryder Cup. And we're always looking for reasons that we are going to do well and to big up what we've got. But you know, we'd have liked it to have been closer, but I said to John sort of on Sunday evening when we had a catch up, you know, even if we'd have turned up and all of our big players had been in form and we'd have played really well and the pairings would have been what most people would have liked to have seen or perhaps thought we should have seen, it would probably have just been a case of not losing by as much. I think to go in and beat that American team, when you look at how well they played in the end, in all honesty, it just wasn't going to happen. I think we have to hold our hands up and say, right now, those 12 American players are significantly superior than our top 12. And that's golf and it's cyclical. And, you know, it comes around. And hopefully in a couple of years' time at Marco Simone, we will be back again and we'll have a new generation. And I think the fact they've gone through that generational change was massive for them. You know, Stricker was saying that 6 rookies might not actually be a bad thing because they didn't have any scar tissue. And you saw that. There wasn't the scar tissue from previous Ryder Cups. And also, they just seemed like a united team. They seemed to have quite a European atmosphere in that team room rather than the splits and the chasms of the past. Brooks and Bryson feud didn't seem to matter. And the younger guys like Xander, JT, Spieth, Finau, all embraced it and all got on with each other. Koepka even, you know, the quotes afterwards suggested they just had a bit of a laugh and they loved it.
I got to say, though, I think the Americans, when I look at them now, I just see You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, form will always change, you know, but I just think their team for the next three, four Ryder Cups are going to be unbelievable and very strong. We're going to have to be very clever on the way we set up our own golf courses when we come back to Europe. We know what we got to do. I think Le Golf National will tell anyone. Were you at golf, Le Golf National, Jamie, as well?
No, I wasn't there. This was my first Ryder Cup. So, yeah. So I know my first Ryder Cup and I bring home a record defeat for Europe. Apologies about that.
No, no.
Jamie, I'm afraid you're not invited to Marco Simone now. There's something. Yeah, no.
No. But, mate, the way they'll set up the courses as well, I mean, you know, Thomas Bjorn got it right last time. It wasn't Patrick's turn to be able to choose how he's going to set up the golf course. It was all down to Steve Stricker and his rest of his team, how they wanted it for their players. I think Italy will bring a whole different beast. It's going to be a survival of the fittest for me when it comes to that course because it's proper hilly. So, yeah, those caddies are having a few bevies at the end of the day. They have to be pretty clean come morning or they're going to make 36 right there.
Well, that's an interesting point you mentioned. It is a really big difference, actually, home field advantage in the Ryder Cup in recent years. Basically, the only away team that's won in the last six, I want to say, is the miracle at Medina.
And which was a freak result.
Freak result. And actually, the last three or four, aside from that, have been pretty one-sided when you look at the final scoreline. Do we need to look at either having someone independent setting up the courses so they aren't so heavily favoured towards the home team, or taking it outside of Europe or America? I know it's controversial, but
maybe I definitely don't think the latter. I think
I was going to say maybe the former of
USA or Europe. But I think there has been an argument for quite some time to say that there should maybe be an independent setter-upper of the golf courses. What I always sort of struggle to understand is why we seem to be playing two fundamentally different styles of golf. I mean, you look at that European team and the vast majority of them play on the PGA Tour. So are they really, you know, are you really going to tell me that Rory McIlroy and John Rahm play a completely different style of golf to Dustin Johnson and Xander Schauffele and Justin Thomas? Well, they don't, do they? But it's sort of more at the bottom end of the European team where maybe guys are more used to playing on the European Tour, where there's maybe more of a premium on accuracy off the tee and ball striking. The worry is going forward, if you keep going to these extremes, if the US keep setting up their course to the nth degree to suit their guys and we keep setting up courses to the nth degree to suit our guys, then the next generation of golfers that you're bringing on, that's only going to get more and more exaggerated, the difference, the gulf between the two sides or the difference in styles between the two sides. So it would be nice to see the meet in the middle somewhere. Maybe not in Rome, though. Let's get our win back first.
One after that.
Maybe when it comes to Bethpage, we can have that independent person setting up the course.
I agree, mate. I was gonna say, Jamie, did you get to hang out with any of the caddies that looked like they had a good session down the Coronation Tap? Did they look like they're having a good time?
Yeah, I mean, the caddies are great. They're a huge part of the week. And I was chatting to a few of them, chatted to Finno when he came off on Sunday evening, and chatted to Jamie Lane, Bernd Wiesberger's caddy. You know, they love that week. They really do. And I mean, just everybody does. And I was standing 2 feet away from Shane Lowry when he was doing an interview with some of the Irish journalists. And he was almost sort of, he was welling up and saying, I don't know how I'm going to go back to playing golf on my own. It's just, I wish I played a team sport. I wish I had the talent to play a team sport because this has just been the best experience of my life. And this is from a guy who won the Open Championship on Irish soil. And he's like, that was the best experience of my life this last week. I really don't know how I'm going to replace it. I think a lot of these players, especially the first timers, are going to be left with such an empty feeling inside for the next few weeks. Like, how do they go back to the day job? Because it is such a special week. And everybody just embraced it so much last week. Despite the result, everybody just has created lifetime memories that last a lifetime.
We've got to ask a quick question as well, because do you know what? America has the President's Cup, which is dead handy when it comes to experience for match players, stuff like that. But we used to have the Seve Trophy and a couple of other things. That's kind of unfortunately fallen by the wayside. How do we get that back out? How do we take on the rest of the world, Europe? Do we set up a new event? What would you call it? You know, we need to do some of that. Shane obviously feels like, you know, it's constantly every year there's something coming along that you can keep nice and tight about, you know?
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, the Eurasia Cup used to be a great thing for the captain to sort of cut his teeth and get to know a few guys as well. You know, a bonding week as much as anything else. And yeah. Just a chance to get comfortable in each other's company. And I think we do miss having something like that. Whether there's, this all comes down, as you guys know, to sponsors having the money to bankroll it. And if there is the appetite to have a Eurasia Cup, or I used to love the Sevi Trophy, you know, yeah. GB and I versus Continental Europe. It used to be so much fun. The problem is these guys have now got such packed schedules that are they going to, you know, half of them are living in the States. Are they going to sort of drop everything and jump on a plane for a week for a, you know, a tournament where there isn't prize money, where it's about the pride of representing your nation? I don't know if we're sort of past that era now, but the Americans certainly have embraced the President's Cup in recent years. So I think it would be nice if we had something similar in the years that aren't Ryder Cup years.
I think the Eurasia Trophy needs to come back, because you could put it like sometime around the Asian events, early in the year in the Middle East. You know, you
that's
had
what it was,
right? The previous year. It feels like we're missing a trick. And sponsor-wise as well, you would think, well, the Ryder Cup is the biggest event in golf. And a lot of that is because it's team match play and people really get behind it. Eurasia Cup, I'm sure you could get some real momentum behind that. Of course, it's never going to get to Ryder Cup levels, but you don't need it to. It's like you say, it's that little bit of middle ground. It's that feeder. It's the bit of experience. And also it gets, you know, Asia's a massive market in golfing terms. You know, Japan and Korea as individual countries are bigger markets for golf. They're the second and third biggest markets ahead of Europe as a whole. So money-wise, sponsor-wise, surely the European Tour have got to be able to get that off the ground again, if the intent is there to do it and they can find a place on the schedule, as you say. And it's got to be worth it, because it's great experience for players and captains, and it would just be another great event, wouldn't it? I'd happily sit down now and watch another week of team match play golf, yeah, or in, you know, 4 or 5 months' time at the start of next year around the Middle East swing or whatever. So as you say, Jamie, maybe the players are there anyway, because a lot of them tend to go to the Middle East for those first 3-4 weeks of the season. I think it needs to be back on the schedule.
Yeah, I don't know whether the reason that it didn't happen yet this year was purely COVID related, but I actually went out to Kuala Lumpur in 2018 for the Eurasia Cup, and it was a brilliant week. And, you know, Thomas Bjorn, I think it definitely got something out of it in terms of getting to know the players as much as anything else and getting comfortable in their company. He got some big names that came out for it, the likes of Henrik Stenson, Paul Casey made the trip out for it. And then a few of the other guys who were sort of clearly going to be on the team in Paris, the likes of Tommy Fleetwood, Alex Noren, but hadn't yet been in that team environment yet. So I think everybody got something out of it. The unfortunate thing about that one was it was Malaysia time. So it was on at like 3 o'clock in the morning back here. And I don't think it had much of a TV audience back home. But as you said, if you sort of meet in the middle and do it somewhere in the Middle East, then the times aren't obscene. The players are there anyway. So yeah, it's sounds like we've got a plan, guys. Let's take it to the European Tour. As long as you get a cut of the profits, then I think that's a good idea.
Happy Dave. I'm all in for that, all in. It's your first...
Wait, is that... Oh, yeah, go on.
First Ryder Cup, Jamie. What was the best moment? What's the everlasting memory you're going to take with you? What stands out?
I've got two memories that I think I'll remember for a long time. One was that Saturday evening, being stood next to the 18th green, 10 yards away from where Shane Lowry was standing. And everybody had sort of formed a horseshoe around the green. Shane's dad and some of the backroom staff were on one side, and I was standing on the other side with a few of the managers and the caddies. And when he drained that putt, like just the release of emotion from him was incredible. We were all hugging each other. It was, I mean, the gig was probably up at that point in terms of the ground that Europe had to make up, but just to see how much it meant for him to get his first point as a Ryder Cup player was wonderful. So that was a moment I'll always remember. And then being standing at the back of the 16th green when Rory came off on Sunday, and after he'd sort of given the caddies a few hugs and given his wife Erica a hug, he came over and gave me a big hug and was just sort of sobbing on my shoulder. And I just told him, listen, you've got absolutely nothing to apologize for. You're a champion and your country's so proud of you. And you we'll get them back in Italy sort of thing. And he just sort of said, thanks, pal. And that was a moment I'll remember because... Mm-hmm. You know, to see Rory McIlroy so vulnerable and emotional. Just goes to, I mean, just underlines what it means to this, to these guys. Mm-hmm. And that interview with Henny that he gave after his match really just showed that this is something special. This, and anybody questioning players not caring, watch that Rory McIlroy interview, or watch Henny's interview with Lee Westwood off the back of the 18th, or Ian Poulter breaking down in tears when he'd finished his match. It means absolutely everything to them. So those are the memories that will stand out for a lifetime for me.
Yeah. They're awesome, man. Did you get yourself any nice bits of memorabilia, mate, to come back with? Have you got like a nice little mug? Have you got yourself
I've got a little bit of merch. I didn't go overboard in the shop because it's bloody expensive.
But, yeah.
I've got a few little bits and bobs, yeah. I'm not sure if it's a Ryder Cup I really want to have a lasting memory of in terms of record defeat. Maybe I'll spend a bit more on Marco Simone in 2 years' time. I got a few bits and bobs. I just wanted to go back, actually circle back to John's earlier point about how the fact that this does seem to be the start of an era for US golf, though, because these, and more concerning perhaps for Europe, will be our strength over them was always the team unity, right? That's something we had. We'd sussed that out, and it was something they always struggled with. This team now has that US team. They're so comfortable in each other's company. They enjoy each other's company so much. A lot of them grew up together, the likes of Jordan Spieth, Justin Thomas, Patrick Cantlay, Xander Schauffele. They grew up knowing each other's kids. And I see now that unity that they have, that concerns me greatly. All those guys are in their 20s and going to be around for quite some time. You add in the likes of Sam Burns, Will Zalatoris, Matt Wolf, who haven't even played in a Ryder Cup yet, and they're only going to get better over the next few years. And all the while that these guys are getting better and better, there's a production line coming out of college all the time as well. So that's the scary thing for Europe. And I'm sure we'll come on to this, but I was compiling yesterday on my trip to Chicago Airport, or 2 days ago, a list of European players in their 20s who we can perhaps, you know, keep our fingers crossed will kick on now over the next 2 years, next 4 years, because at the moment there's a gulf in talent, and it's something that will be concerning for future Ryder Cup captains for sure.
Yeah, there's always that transition period, isn't there?
Yeah.
America have gone through it over the last few years, and now this is the new generation, and we've just seen them explode onto the Ryder Cup scene this time. We're very much in that position now, and it might take one or two Ryder Cups for it to fully work its way through to get that established.
Because it feels like the end of a generation for us as well.
Yeah,
right?
100%.
The last one for Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood, perhaps Paul Casey as well. And it feels we're now sort of falling between those two stools. We're in a little sort of gap between generations. And who is going to be the backbone of the European team in Paris, in Bethpage, in Ireland, or sorry, in Italy, in Bethpage, in Ireland. That's what we need to sort of be concerned about, I think.
Well, we'll dig deep into that list in a little bit, because we do want to look forward ahead. But just before we do, a couple of sort of more controversial issues that I did want to just discuss and sort of address on here. So
not like you.
Yeah, I've got, not unlike me, to go in for the controversy. But the gimme putts thing with Bryson DeChambeau putting his putter length down. My opinion always has been of gimme putts, like, you shouldn't expect to be given them because it shows weakness. And if it's that big, that easy a putt that you're going to make a massive remonstration that it should have been given to you, well, just tap it in then if it's that easy. That's my approach to that. Like, there's no written rule that a gimme, it's not disrespectful to not give an 18-inch or 2-foot putt. That's golf. Like, you have to hole them 51 weeks of the year. And if it is that easy that it should be a gimme, you shouldn't be bothered about tapping them in. What do you guys think?
I forget. Who were his opponents that day? I forget.
Good shake, you cheeky bugger.
I'll have a little look while you start.
It was him and Scotty Scheffler, but I can't remember now for the life of me who they were playing.
It was Saturday, wasn't it? I'll just quickly check.
When he hit it 417 yards on that par 5, was it? Was it the same round?
No, it was Fleetwood and Hovland. It was the Saturday afternoon.
Yeah. So if I was Victor and Tommy, I'd be thinking, brilliant. We've got underneath the skin already. There's only a hole gone, and we've already got underneath the skin. I think, as you said, it shows a weakness. And I also think when you're talking about Bryson in particular, mate, you've got a putter that's longer than everybody else's, so don't be
a lot of people pointed out.
Exactly.
You don't be trying to draw attention to it. You know, you haven't got a leg to stand on. Your putting stroke, as far as I'm concerned, is an illegal putting stroke. So maybe don't draw attention to that fact. Yeah, it wasn't a great moment from Bryson. I have to say, the week as a whole for Bryson, yeah, I think was a really positive week. He saw it for the first time, he felt loved, mm-hmm, and he thrived in that atmosphere. But that was his one little Bryson. He has to remind us occasionally that he's still a bit of a dweeb. And that was his one little Bryson moment where it was like, mate, come on.
He can't resist it, can he?
I'm with you, Jamie. He's got to have his 45 minutes. He's just got to have it. You know what I mean? He's just got to have that when his cheese falls off the cracker. You know, it's just his Bryson, isn't it? You know what I mean? It's just, you know, a nutbag. So, but do you know what? It was a show and a half from Bryson DeChambeau. I'll give him that. It was unbelievable. And my main man, definitely DJ. My goodness, that man looked obsessed out on the golf course. Looked obsessed.
Yeah. And also for me, provided one of the moments in the press conference afterwards as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then there's a sort of 2 second pause and he goes, next question. Everything about it was absolutely brilliant.
Mate, I was doing the math on that, Jamie, because he's come off the green. When he came off the green, it was another hour until Fitzpatrick came off. So he'd have been straight on the pop of like having all this lovely bottles of Moët or whatever they were dishing out. He'd have had a tanked up of that. Then by the time that interview come along, you'd probably think in another hour had gone by. So that's 2 hours.
I don't think it was as long as that. You know, I think it was about 45 minutes to an hour between DJ finishing his round and that press conference.
And being
really? So, I
think he's got slightly, you know, I think he's a bit of a lightweight. DJ,
I was going to say, are you calling DJ a lightweight?
Yeah, I am.
But on the flip side, drunk DJ is the best DJ. Like, he should get drunk for all his interviews, because other interviews, he gives nothing away, doesn't say a lot. You know, if it's a Prost round interview, give him 20 minutes after he's come off, get a couple of beers in his hands, and then interview him after he's chugged them back.
Exactly. It was very funny. It was a funny moment. Anyway, Kit, sorry, we've gone off on a tangent. There was
I love a tangent.
What's your other controversial moment?
The other one was Brooks Koepka and Daniel Berger attempting to get a drop that I think we all know weren't entitled to. And the more significant bit of it, the reaction to not getting the drop from Brooks Koepka swearing at the rules officials. I mean, that was pretty unsavory. I know that obviously overall Ryder Cup's brilliant, positive, huge thing. He needs the rule book thrown at him for that. That it has no place in the game whatsoever, does it?
No, I thought that was a poor moment. I was about 50 yards away from that. I was following that match. And I was actually standing about 5 yards away from John Rahm at the time. And he sort of kept glancing back saying, what on earth's taking so long there? And then Sergio walked back across the fairway. I mean, there was a quite funny moment when Brooks Koepka asked the official, have you ever seen me hit a ball before? And he said, I've seen you hit plenty. And Sergio spat out his drink because he thought it was such a funny comment. But at that point, it was all sort of fun and games. You thought, fine. And then when he asked for the second opinion, okay, fine, he's entitled to that as well. But then when he starts threatening them and saying, look, if I break my wrist, this is on you. It's not a great look, is it? You know, Brandel Chamblee was very outspoken about it and said that should have been an automatic loss of the hole.
He's probably right.
Unsportsmanlike conduct, which was maybe a fair point as well. And if you look at it, it was just a big tuft of grass, for crying out loud. It wasn't exactly.
And he still got on the green.
Oh, guess what, Brooks? You hit it on the green and you didn't break your wrist. So what were you moaning about?
I mean, beyond the ball was, it's like a bit of a sleeper or something beyond the ball that he thought through his follow through might connect. He was never going to connect with it. Mark, who's was the second opinion referee that we see week in, week out on the European tour, does an amazing job. He just said to him, like you just said, Jamie, it's all on you if I break your wrist. And Mark's like, shut up, man, get on with it. You ain't having it either. You know, just get on with it. You know, I made my decision and that's final. And I just admire Mark how he set off. But he could have been a little bit more, he could have
You'll know this better than me probably, John. But when it comes to the Ryder Cup, it's a mixture of officials from the PGA of America and from the European Tour, right?
Yeah.
So I think, I may be making a sweeping generalization here, but I think a lot of the guys that play week in, week out in the PGA Tour, would I be fair in saying, not that they're weaker officials, but they think they can get away with a bit more and they think they can sort of, you know, argue their way around with some of those PGA Tour officials. Whereas when you've got a PGA of America and European Tour official, you can maybe get away, you can't get away with as much stuff. And maybe that was the source of Brooks Koepka's frustration, that he would have thought on the PGA Tour, I'll be able to argue my point here. But he wasn't, he wasn't getting his way in a Ryder Cup.
No, when I think the rules are the rules. I mean, you know, this. That's a good question, though, Jamie. I can't answer that one. Got me right under the bus. But what was it? I mean, that would literally, I would say, you know, I think they do a great job. I think the second opinion was a great thing anyway. I think the rules officials that I hang out with on the European Tour are absolutely marvelous. Yeah. And when I was on the PGA Tour as well, they're very approachable, very ready to help you in any way, shape or form. But they ain't gonna try and bend it to your advantage. No doubt about it. But you can argue your point. Many times I've stood there, I've asked for a drop and I've gone, no, I want it there. No, I think it's there. And they go, no, it's there. No, I think it's there. And they, you know, all of a sudden, I there's a chance of me being able to reach the green over, you know, laying up. And, you know, I know the frustration sometimes, and you swear blind that you're doing the right thing. But I loved how they handled it anyway. And yeah, I can't say a bad thing one way or the other over any of them.
The interesting thing about that situation on the whole American versus European Tour officials was it was the American official who gave the first opinion. He was the one walking with the group. So then the European Tour official, Mark Litton, who came in, he was the second opinion. So you'd already had an American stand up to Brooks and Berger, quite rightly so, and say, no, I don't believe. And then the European Tour official came in and backed him up. Yeah. So it was absolutely spot on. As you say, he's got every right to get an official in the first place to have a look at it and put his point across. He's got every right to ask for a second opinion. The issue is, once both those opinions have gone, no, I don't believe you should get a free drop here, that is case closed. You crack on. Yeah. You don't spend another 5 minutes remonstrating and then swear at them. That's what you don't do.
It's Brooks Koepka, isn't it? He don't care.
Well, you know what? I saw a great tweet, and I'm not sure who it was that put this out, and I'm paraphrasing it, but it's John Rahm has the bearing, the intimidation, and the personality or character or something, like three things like that, that Brooks Koepka thinks he does.
Yes, I saw that.
So like John Rahm has that big man persona. He is a big man. He's imposing. He's got the game to back it up. He's got the respect of people. Koepka thinks he's that. He thinks he's the big man on campus and doesn't quite pull it off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I tell you who didn't surprise me was Patrick Cantlay, how he came out in his interview prior to the Ryder Cup kicking off. What a fantastic interview. I mean, John's was brilliant as well, John Rahm's. There was a couple of guys that give great interviews, but a better insight to Patrick Cantlay, because he's a quiet man, isn't he? Silent but violent in the sense of his game. You know, just like one of your farts kit.
And bowel movements as well, is he?
Yeah. But I mean, literally, that dog is going absolutely.
Oh, so Jamie's got his dog.
This is what you don't see on a podcast. I've been trying to deal with an absolutely insane cockapoo here.
What's cockapoo called, Jamie?
This is Twix.
Twix,
and she is determined to chew the skin off my left hand before this podcast is out. Twix, calm down, man. She's an absolute nutcase.
She's excited about the Ryder Cup as we are.
Yeah, I think she might be an American fan, judging by how excited she is.
Oh, no. Oh, we can't be having that.
Carry on. Ignore her.
Yeah.
The Cantlay and Rahm thing was interesting, because I don't want to... Obviously, we're very Ryder Cup focused, but just quickly on the player of the year, it should have been Rahm, shouldn't it? Not Cantlay, surely.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say two things about this. One, it absolutely should have been John Rahm. I think he's head and shoulders above the rest at the moment, and he showed that over the Ryder Cup as well. I mean, he's just phenomenal. There's nothing more to say on that. But the other thing I would say is, does it matter? Does it really matter?
This is true.
Like, you know, how many Player of the Years did Jack Nicklaus win? How many Player of the Years did Tiger Woods win? It's an irrelevant award. It's a byproduct of winning other tournaments, isn't it? And at the end of your career, you look back on the majors and your PGA Tour victories, and your Ryder Cup experiences, you don't look back on how many Player of the Year awards you've got. So I think the Americans make a way bigger deal of it than we do. And the other thing that they do that with, it reminds me a bit of their Hall of Fame. Like, they make such a big deal of being in the Hall of Fame. Does it matter? Being in the Hall of Fame is an offshoot of having had a great career where you've won lots of trophies and you've made a difference. Like,
well, the thing about the Player of the Year thing is, you're right, it's an offshoot of how many tournaments you win. John's cracking up at the dock. It's an offshoot of how many tournaments you win. And the records will say that Patrick Cantlay won 4 PGA Tour events this year and John Rahm won 1. Problem is, that doesn't quite tell the full story, does it? Because of those 4 that Cantlay won, 1 was the Memorial when John Rahm had a 6-shot lead with a round to go and had to unfortunately withdraw because of COVID. So that takes it 3-2. And then the other one was the Tour Championship, which Cantlay got given a win for, but obviously started with an advantage in terms of the scores with their adjusted scoring. But in terms of actual stroke play, John Rahm tied winning that with Kevin Na. So in actual fact, really, John Rahm won 3 tournaments and Patrick Cantlay won 2.
Yeah.
In reality, or in golf. Also, he finished above him in all of the majors. Cantlay didn't have a major top 10, and there were 6 majors in that season because of the way it all broke down with when we came back from the COVID pandemic. No major top 10s for Cantlay, and John Rahm won the US Open. So, yeah, ridiculous. But as you say, Jamie, it doesn't matter anyway. So,
exactly.
Don't know why I brought it up.
On the subject of John Rahm, though, look, he was incredible. And he just has such a high ceiling as well. Like, he never seems to drop below a certain standard. And I know that he lost his singles match on Sunday, but that was because Scottie Scheffler just found something from somewhere. Like, birdieing 5 of the first 6 holes was just unbelievable. And maybe John Rahm just did run a bit out of steam in the end. But he had another really lovely candid moment that I'll remember is standing on the 17th tee box. I can't remember who was coming through at the time. But John Rahm had finished his match. He was doing a couple of interviews. Sergio was standing about 5 yards away from him. And then he finished one of his interviews and he turned around. I was standing with Solly from the No Laying Up podcast. And he just turned around to the 2 of us and went, whew. And I said, you're right. And he goes, yeah. And then he just said, you know what? My experiences over the last 3 days, and in particular, my experiences with this guy, and he pointed at Sergio, are way better than anything I experienced at the US Open. Like, those were the memories that I will remember forever. Getting to play with this guy is just unforgettable. I've enjoyed every minute of it. And it sort of, it goes along with what I said about Shane Lowry as well, that he considers this Ryder Cup experience, a Ryder Cup that they lost by 10 points, he considers a greater experience than winning an Open on Irish soil. Yeah. And that underlines just how special it is for these guys. When you hear John Rahm, who I think is going to go on and win 7 or 8 majors, when you hear him saying this experience playing alongside Sergio Garcia was a great experience ever, that kind of sums it all up.
I'm with you, Jamie. And the thing is, what's so sad is that, you know, when you're amateurs, these youngsters are coming through, they play lots of match play, but as soon as they turn professional, that's it. It's done. It's all about you, mate. It's an individual sport. It's all 72 hole stroke play. It's never match play anymore. But when you get that unity, 12 guys come together, plus your captains and vice captains, and then you get the crowd on your side as well. It's just different gravy. I mean, I that was the one biggest thing I missed as a, you know, when I turned professional, is that you just had to write off match play. You're never going to play it again unless you have a throw the balls up around your local golf course on your week off. That's the only time you're going to have a little match play event. That is it. It's such a shame. But I think, like, Rahm, Sergio embodies that every time he puts on a Ryder Cup jersey. You know, he's a man possessed, isn't he? He is a man possessed. He just loves it. And that shows you why the tears are there for Lee Westwood, Poulter, Rory McIlroy. I mean, they're all there because it's something they don't really get to do. I was going to go back to Padraig Harrington because there's something I was going to say about that man, because I've been lucky to follow him the last probably 3-4 weeks at different events and chatting to him a lot in his caddy. And I was just, I mean, it just, he wouldn't have, every stone, you know, was, you know, on turn, it was just perfect. You know, he's not someone that would leave anything to chance. He would cover all bases, and I think this is why he was such a good captain. And unfortunately, he ran into a freight train of just like top talent players that just overpowered his players. It just was what it was. And like Poulter was saying, he hopes, you know, Padraig Harrington doesn't get as much bad press about it, because he doesn't deserve it. You know, yeah, what can you do? I mean, for Harrington, if anyone that knows Padraig Harrington, you know, the guy leaves no stone unturned. It's just relentless what he can go through. You know what I mean? He's got every gizmo in the world at his house. He tries to figure out everything in his own game. You know, he's mental like that. And he's, you know, the enthusiasm he brings when he's on the range and he's on the golf course. I mean, his work ethic. I mean, I was on the back of the range with him up in Scotland, Jamie. And he honestly was just on there, and he got the buzz. He was hitting driver, and he's flashed. I went, "Cool, that was good. What's this one?" He's pegging it up so quickly. He's like waggle waggle, and he's walking through it. And I'm like, "Geez, Louise, you're trying to figure something out." And it's just the energy he brings as well. His energy would have been so awesome to the European team.
Yeah.
Oh, it would have been so good. And like that's where I can't fault him on any of his picks. I can't, you know, how he set up the four balls and foursomes. I can't see that as a problem, any of them. I really can't. It just comes down to America play better at the end of the day. And that is it.
Pure and have players in form, like I said, you know,
Something
Padraig Harrington can do, but the fact that mostly the English players, I have to say, Matt Fitzpatrick, Lee Westwood, Tommy Fleetwood, Tyrrell Hatton, they're all excellent players who have excelled in previous Ryder Cups. Well, maybe not Fitz yet, but, you know, they all just happen to hit a dip in form at the wrong time. And I agree with you. I really hope that the history books, the unfortunate thing is both captains said this as they arrived on Monday in their opening press conference as well. Good captains can lose Ryder Cups and bad captains can win Ryder Cups. And you seem to be judged by whatever the outcome is. I hope the history books don't recognize Padraig Harrington as a disastrous captain who oversaw the worst European defeat in history, because everything the players have said was he was an unbelievable captain, and the camaraderie and the morale in that team room was unbelievable. But as I said before, we just ran into a freight train this time.
Would you do like a Tony Jacklin? Would you have Harrington again for the next one if he wanted it?
No, I think now that, and this is a sort of byproduct of having such a strong European dominance over the last couple of decades, is that there are so many people queuing up now to be captain that actually somebody big, in fact, potentially two big
one
names,
one or two will miss out,
are going to miss out. And I've sort of, it's quite fun afterwards to try to sort of speculate about who the future captains are going to be. And I can already predict that one or two big, big names are going to miss out.
Well, you think you've got Donald McDowell, Stenson, Rose starting to get to that, Westwood, Poulter, Casey, Garcia.
Yeah.
That's eight guys I've just reeled off there who are.
Yeah. And the European Tour traditionally.
Five or six Ryder Cups to get them into, essentially.
The European Tour traditionally like to have people who are still in touch with the current players, so are in their late 40s. In fact, Padraig, I think, was the first European captain who was in his 50s for quite some time, and he's only just turned 50. So I think it's different now because players are playing for longer as well, but I would have thought. Just this is thinking off the top of my head. I think Luke Donald is the prime candidate for Italy because he's done the vice captaincy a couple of times. I think it would have been Westwood, but from everything I'm hearing, and I did a really telling interview with Lee Westwood on Sunday night, he's not ready to do it just yet. He sees it as sort of semi-retirement when you accept the Ryder Cup captaincy, and he's still playing too well for that. So I think 23 will be Luke Donald. 25, Beth Page, will be either Poulter or Westwood. 27 in Ireland, makes sense, GMAC. Then 29 will be whichever one of Poulter or Westwood didn't do 25. Then you're getting suddenly into 31, Henrik Stenson. By 2033, Sergio Garcia is going to be 53 years old.
How old? So I mean, Justin Rose is part of.
So there, Justin Rose.
By then as well, you're looking at him potentially missing out.
Yeah, so Justin Rose has missed out there on my equation. And yeah, look, it's inevitable that a big name is going to miss out at least.
Very true. I mean, looking ahead, you've mentioned it already, John. Marco Simone is the host for in a couple of years' time, 2023. You were there for the DS Automobiles Italian Open not so long ago, just a few weeks ago. You got to walk the course. Nikolai Højgaard won there, of course. Perhaps a good omen for in a couple of years' time. Tell us about that course, John, because it might not be as European as the Europeans want it to be.
Well, do you know what? Where they built it is unbelievable. It's, you know, 20 minutes, 15 minutes outside Rome, beautiful. Get to go and see everything. So touristy-wise, it would be amazing. You know, people coming in to watch it. Obviously, you know, everything permitting and everything going smoothly. But what a golf course. I mean, but my goodness, is it hilly. Jeez Louise. It's honestly, from the 8th green up to the 12th tee box, I mean, you'll look at it, I'm every caddy's nightmare holding a massive golf bag in, if it's 30 degrees of, 28 degrees of heat as well. My goodness gracious me, mountain goat stuff, literally. It's unbelievable. Like, I think there's probably 2-3 holes total on the whole of the golf course that are flat-ish. Apart from that, everything's uphill, straight downhill, side lies. The rough is brutal, which is great for us. I mean, we've got to try and narrow that up as much as we can. There's a couple of blind shots, not many though, which is quite fortunate. Everything you can pretty much see. 18 is just an absolute, the par threes in general are unbelievable. Literally, they're so hard. 17, oh my goodness, never seen such a tight green in all my life. So accuracy is a massive thing. But this rough, what it's kind of like, it's got like one of your, you know, it's a beautiful cone. You're blessed with good air. But mate, it's just like, it's relentless, this stuff. You know what I mean? A ball can go underneath it. You've got no chance of getting out of it. I remember watching Fitzy at the back of the green. He had the rough like this coming this way and another bit of rough like that. And the ball's gone up here and come back in between these two slots. And he's trying to go that way.
Yeah.
Well, he can. So he hits it and it goes like 2 inches, a bit like Bryson DeChambeau's chip at the back of the green that time where the lie was that bad, it just went nowhere. Then he fluffed it again, you know, because it was still in a horrendous lie. So these are the kind of lies you get round Simone Golf Club. So it's going to be amazing. The infrastructure that they've had to do as well is unbelievable. There's plenty of space. You can see it where the stands are going to be already. And the banks.
That was going to be my next question. In terms of the spectator experience, are there natural amphitheatres? Are there holes next to each other?
Yeah, mate, there's crisscrossing going on all the time. It's going to be manic. It will be manic and it will be amazing. It literally, I take my hat off to them. I know what they were about to do. So as soon as we finished the event, they were about to get stuck into the driving range. So they were starting to remodel that, getting everything into position. That was the next bit they were going to do. But you can tell, I mean, down 18, down the hole, down the left hand side, down the right hand side, and wrapping itself around. I mean, they run adjacent with the tenth and the first and the 18th. So the 10th runs down the right as you look up the 18th, and the first one's down the left as you look up 18. But it's amazing golf course. I think it's going to be survival of the fittest. I think you lose a couple of me and you, Jamie, would do well, mate. We'll lose a couple of stone round there, walking round. So fingers crossed, I get the old nod and I'm out there, because honestly, it's a proper walk. It really is. So, but it's going to be a great venue, amazing venue.
Jamie, you mentioned your list of Europeans in their 20 somethings that you've been drawing up. Who's on that hit list we need to be looking out for?
Shall I read it out? Well, a lot of these, a couple of them near the top are obviously already Ryder Cup players and their proven talents. A lot are potential players with potential. A lot are players who have stalled a little bit that maybe need to kick on in the next stage of their career. Mm-hmm. But I'll read out the list. So these are all guys in their 20s. John Rahm, Victor Hovland, Matt Fitzpatrick, Tyrrell Hatton, Bob McIntyre, Rasmus Højgaard, Nikolai Højgaard, Thomas Detry, Thomas Peters, Guido Migliozzi, Matthias Schwab, Sam Horsfield, Victor Perez, Callum Hill, Aaron Rye, Alex Fitzpatrick, Ludwig Åberg, Sami Välimäki, Antoine Rosner, Matthias Schmid, and Vincent Norman. With apologies to any Europeans in their 20s that I've forgotten. But, you know, there's some there, look, obviously the likes of Ludwig Åberg and Alex Fitzpatrick are still amateurs and they're still to turn pro and show their potential. The likes of Thomas Peters, Thomas Detry, we know their talent, but have they really kicked on as they get into their late 20s? Not yet. They've got a big 2 years ahead of them.
Yeah.
I think the likes of Guido Migliozzi and Sam Horsfield, who are still in their early 20s,
the sky's the limit for those guys if they can reach their true potential. And the Højgaard twins, I mean, they're 20 and they're already both European Tour winners.
Absolutely. I mean, Ludvig Åberg, just to give a bit of context, is 3 in the world amateur golf rankings now, a Swedish player. Alex Fitzpatrick, 4 in the world amateur golf rankings. There's also a young Spanish lad who has a lot of hype around called David Puig, who's 5th in the world amateur rankings. All of those guys, really good, playing in the American collegiate system as well and playing well, like making their mark. We've seen how quickly players can go now from the college system to being in the Ryder Cup. We saw it with Hovland. We've seen it with Rahm in the past, the American guys as well. It's Murakawa. Not beyond the realms of possibility that one of those guys is in the next Ryder Cup. Or, you know, it might not that happen, but it's there's a chance. I'm strangely optimistic, actually, after that little list you've read out there. What about you, John? You've seen a lot of these players in action, certainly the Højgaard twins.
Definitely, but they all got to raise their games. They've got to find another gear again. They just have to. They have to go out. They have to learn. They have to win. They have to put themselves in contention. We got to see them on the bigger stage as well. We got to see them on the biggest stages. We got to see them at the Masters. We got to see them at the Opens contending. We got to see them at, you know, the majors and world events. We got to see it. You know, I think the picks as well, when it comes to, you know, next time as well, are we going to have 4? Are we going to have 5? What are we going to do? You know, does that lend itself to people that are traveling all over the world a little bit easier and you're able to grab people that are in form a little bit easier? I don't know. When I look at all those and I followed every one of them, they're all unbelievable. They are got the star quality that we need. I mean, I was watching that Matthias Schmid in Holland where Broberg won. And I can't believe how good that guy is.
Yeah.
He's
just turned pro, hasn't he?
He's just turned pro, mate.
The leading amateur at the Open in the summer and then turned pro just after, yeah.
Yeah.
But he's so cool. He's relaxed. He's got a great pace about him and nothing phases him. He had one weak shot, which cost him the tournament, you know, I think, which was on the 13th of par 3, real strong par 3. And it was out of kilter kind of shot, came out of nowhere. Everything else was so solid. But I was so impressed with him. He's a man. I think you can nearly cement him in there. I think we're going to see great things from him. But I see Sam Horsfield, like you said, and Guido Migliozzi. Sam is just a real gutsy performer that wants to go absolutely everything. And I think he would absolutely love it because obviously he's just fed off his mate, you know, Ian Poulter, who's a Ryder Cup legend. You know what I mean? There's no any better than him. So, and just the Højgaard twins, after following that in Italy as well, seeing Nicolai do it and at the back of the green, I was stood with Rasmus Højgaard and seeing what kind of unity they're bringing. And, you know, you can also feel the vibe from, you know, our past winning captain, Thomas Bjorn. You know, he knows full well what the capabilities are of these boys. He knows exactly what kind of minerals they've got for a Ryder Cup. And I think he's bang on. And there's so much more out of talent. Like you said, Callum Hill, Bob McIntyre. But Mackers is just, Bobber is just a breath of fresh air. Now, that is a man who would love to play a team event.
The thing about Bob McIntyre is actually his best performances have come on the biggest stages. A couple of top 10s in Open Championships already. Tied 12th in his very first appearance at Augusta, which not many people do. And I think he had the most birdies that week of anybody at the Masters as well. And he's only got one European Tour win, and it came in a funny little event in Cyprus. But he needs to kick on in the next couple of years now as well and prove that he's at that level, which I think he can be. Aaron Rye and Matthias Schwab, I think, have both got their PGA Tour cards now.
So that's going to be big for them this year, playing PGA Tour.
Yeah, so they've all got talent, they've all got ability. I mentioned the two Belgian boys, Detri and Peters. They need to kick on because we know they've got the talent, and for whatever reason, maybe they don't have it in the top 4 inches or something. But
Peters at Hazeltine, 4 points. He was the top European point scorer as a rookie in the Ryder Cup at Hazeltine. At that point, everyone was saying he's destined for greatness, future world number one. We all know it hasn't quite worked out, but he's still a young man and golf is a sport you play for a long time. There's still time and we know he can do it in a Ryder Cup. And he has come back into a bit of form the last few weeks, actually, Thomas Peters. He does look to be starting to get back to somewhere where he was when he was winning those European Tour events and getting into the Ryder Cup the back half of this summer. So I'm optimistic that Peters can make a real charge and would be an asset to that team. like you say, there's a lot of talent there. So much potential, as you say, Jamie. Mm. And John, you're right. It's which 3, 4, 5, 6 of those players are going to be the ones to elevate their games in the next 2 years, because they've all got the potential to do so. And some of those names that we've mentioned there are going to explode in the next couple of years and hopefully get on that Ryder Cup team.
And the other thing I'd say is, you know, we all know how fickle and cyclical golf can be. And, you know, guys who are playing incredibly well now can also disappear in a couple of years' time. Look where Jordan Spieth was 2 years ago. We wouldn't have thought that he'd get back to the top of the world rankings again. No. But he has. And you look at that American team this time around. Look, I don't think the likes of Morikawa and Schofield aren't going anywhere, but Patrick Cantlay's body's pretty brittle. He's held together by bits of metal at the moment. So's Brooks Koepka. You know, they can fall away very quickly. DJ, you know, look, he was a stud over the last 3 days, but he's 37 years of age. I've listed already the young American golfers coming through as well, but we don't know if they're going to kick on and be wonderful, or we don't know if they're going to just hit a little bit of a lull in their career. So we'll see what happens.
And some of those American players that you mentioned, with the quality that's just behind them, they don't really need to drop off the planet to not get in the team. They just need to have fall to 30 in the world rankings, essentially, and they probably won't be in the team. Like, they don't have to be bad. You've just got such quality coming through that, you know, it's very easy to see a Patrick Reed or a Will Zalatoris or a Billy Horschel or a Sam Burns or whoever else, a Webb Simpson coming back into it over the next couple of years. Like, everyone's saying that is going to be the American team for the next, 3 or 4 Ryder Cups. And if that will be the backbone to it. But I would be amazed if 9, 10, 11 of the players that represented America this time are representing them in Italy. It's far more likely that it will be 7 or 8 and 4 or 5 will drop off for whatever reason.
Yeah.
So there's all, like you say, it's cyclical, it's form-based. There's always a turnover.
I think the USA have also now finally got the knack of picking horses for courses as well. Mm-hmm. Tim Furyk made a big mistake with the 3 picks, with 3 of his 4 picks for Paris. But look, it wasn't really his fault, because how can you not pick Tiger Woods? He just won the Tour Championship at the time. How can you not pick Phil Mickelson? He's Phil Mickelson. How can you not pick Bryson DeChambeau? He just won 2 of the FedEx playoffs. So they were the picks he had to make, but they were 3 players who were not at all suited to Le Golf National. This time, Stricker chose the likes of Harris English, Tony Finau, Scotty Scheffler, who were bombers made for Whistling Straits. Next time around, it might go the other way again. And whoever the US captain is, probably Zach Johnson, might think that perhaps the likes of Kevin Kisner, Kevin Na, Brian Harman, Billy Horschel, guys who
to America and won,
find fairways and greens, maybe they're the guys to pick next time around. So look, it's all very, it fluctuates, and it's going to be interesting to see how it pans out over the next 2 years.
Yeah, final point, to get that 12-man European team, John, do we need to tweak how we're getting that team? At the moment, it was the leading 4 qualifiers in the European Tour points list, joined by the leading 5 off of the world points list, not already from the European list, and then 3 picks. Does that need tweaking, John?
Well, literally, it's worked in the past. I mean, it's all kind of a little bit changed, but yeah, would I change it? Probably not. I like what we do. Would I say an extra one pick, just because you can go for someone a bit more in form instead of someone that's just lost a little bit's form, you know, had a hot start and able to hold on? Yeah, maybe. Or maybe chuck in an extra one. I would say make it 4 picks instead of 3. I wouldn't go to 6. I don't think that's fair on people that have, you know, earned their spot in the right way. I mean, it's unfortunate that they come to the Ryder Cup and they're not playing their full best because they've had the hottest start in the world, but they're not coming into it strong. But it is what it is. You earn it. You earn it. And everyone wants to play for, you know, in the Ryder Cup team. You know, I try to put myself in that position. If I got off to the hottest start known a man and I was guaranteed to be in the Ryder Cup, but it came to it, I'm in, but I'm not playing good form. Right, I'm going to go there. I'm going to try and find my form. Because you're going to have all your teammates behind you, pulling for you. Come on, John, you can do it, or whoever it may be, you know, and you're going to raise your game. You will find something without question. But it's everyone's goal, ultimate goal. I mean, we had the luxury of working with Sam Torrance at Wentworth Kit. Mm-hmm. I mean, Sam is just a legend of the Ryder Cup, and he was saying his kind of points and how he thought he was going to go about it. And, you know, he likes the three picks, I think, his kind of view on it. And, you know, I mean, literally, it's just the best thing since sliced bread, isn't it? The Ryder Cup, it really is. You know, it's something I wish I was ever to be a part of. I know everyone I know around these neck of the woods, we look at it and we just think, my goodness, what we'd give to be able to play a Ryder Cup, you know, if we were good enough to play a Ryder Cup. And to watch these boys perform and play, and my heart goes out to Lee Westwood. Just want to go back to him quickly because I followed Lee at Wentworth, and I, you know, going around the last couple of holes, he said something to me like, I'm going to take 4 weeks off now. He didn't think he was going to get in the Ryder Cup. He thought he was going to be just outside it and Harrington wouldn't pick him. And I think, you know, he was over the moon to get in, the way it all worked out with Billy Horschel winning and everything like that. And, you know, I really feel sorry for Lee, because there's a time and a time when it comes that you just got to tip your cap and say, I've done it, you know. But what a great, life he's had for the Ryder Cup. My goodness, remember seeing him, he has a little chunky face at, you know, the Ryder Cup when Seve Ballesteros was the captain at Valderrama. I mean, that was probably one of the best things of me watching him. And I've watched him ever since. I'm a massive, massive fan of Lee Westwood. I really am. I just love his game. He's always nice to me. So I ain't got a bad word to say about him. Him and his good lady on the range at, you know, Wentworth, all getting in. So nice and relaxed. He was just, all he wanted to do was get in the Ryder Cup team. That was all his focus. And this is why, you know, he lost the plot a little bit on the golf course, because he thought he lost his place, because it meant so much to him, you know, at Wentworth. But he got his chance and, you know, he got his point. He got his point. He had a son on the bag.
His last one, which it's likely he won the last match, which is important, because he was on a 6-match losing run in the Ryder Cup. To end it with 7 defeats would not have been the right way, as you say, for a man of his stature.
With his boy in the bag, as John says, with his boy in the bag, that is just something that you will never, ever forget. Yeah.
Mate, you can't forget that. And the boy, there can be a few photos up around the house with him and his boy, with his boy on the bag. You guarantee it. There'll be, you know, there's so many great photographers out on that golf course that have caught a few lovely snippets, and that'll be forever and a day with them. And, you know, you can never pass that up. And I think Lee, like you said, he don't want it to be his last. He don't want to be a captain yet. You know, he doesn't know, you know, kind of where he lies on that. He has to go away and think about it, but it's going to make him go back in the gym and try and become something, because do you know what? He still hits it up there with everyone. You know, it's up there with the majority. You know, he's one of the straightest players. You know, he's a streaky putter. Once his putter starts, boom, you know, happy days. He wins tournaments. That's Lee Westwood. He hits greens, fairways and greens all day long. There's no one really better than him. Not as many anyway. And I just think, yeah, give himself a good shout next year, next time. But I think, you know, unfortunately for Lee, yeah, it could be the last one, mate. Bummer.
Jamie, what's your take on the qualification criteria? Because it got skewed by COVID, didn't it? We had a period of qualification.
I think if you're really nitpicking and criticising Padraig, he had the chance when COVID hit to do what Stricker did and go to the 6 picks, or at least tweak it slightly in his favour. Because the problem is, on this team, you had a lot of guys who were in great form in 2019, not even 2020, in 2019. Yeah. And that sort of was skewed by the fact that the process had to be halted and then restarted again. I think 4-4-4 is the way to do it. 4 from the European, 4 from the World Tour, 4 captain's picks. You got to remember, on the European Tour, to get on that European Tour points list, you're also, you know, getting points in majors, WGCs, Rolex events. So you're still going to get the likes of John Rahm, Rory McIlroy, Victor Hovland, Tommy Fleetwood, the big boys. You're still going to get them making that European points list. What you don't want to end up with is guys who are just plugging away and racking up the top 10s in the trophy Hassan De and events like that, who suddenly make it onto the Ryder Cup team, because that's where there's a gulf in class. But I think as long as you tweak it that the majors and the Rolex series events and the WGCs are rewarded.
Well, they're worth so much more in points on the race than you buy, and that's what the European list has gone off. It will organically, the players playing well in the big events will come to the top of that list as well.
Yeah. You know, there was a lot of consternation after Wentworth, the fact that Bernd Wiesberger crept into the team. Bernd was actually, I know he's returned with no points and three losses, but he played well at Whistling Straits. He was really actually quite unlucky. His points return doesn't reflect how well he played. But there's no doubt about it. If this time, if Podrick had had a couple of extra picks, there's a couple of people who would have gone instead, I think. And look, that's just the way it is. But I think he made the decision to go to three picks rather than four, which is what Thomas had for Paris. I imagine whoever the next captain is, and I would put good money on it being Luke Donald, might go back to four picks again. But it doesn't need a vast overhaul. I don't think we need six picks. No.
Six picks is always too much because the guys finishing seventh and eighth, you're always going to pick them anyway. If they've played well enough to finish seventh and eighth on the list, you're not leaving them out, are they? So it's a bit like, yeah, we're saying it's six picks, but in reality, it's only ever four.
Well, that was Podrick's logic to going to three. He said that you very rarely look past the man who's finished ninth. This time, actually, he might look past the man who finished ninth. Yeah. So, look, COVID threw a spanner in the works for everybody, as it has in life generally over the last couple of years.
It did. But we had an amazing Ryder Cup, you know, as we can all... It's the best event in golf, isn't it? One of, if not the best event in sport. And even though we got an absolute drubbing, we still loved it, didn't we? Your first experience there, Jamie, and you'll never forget that. Some of the moments you've shared with us today, just absolutely magnificent and will live with you forever.
Yeah, I mean, it was just the most incredible experience.
What was your first ever Ryder Cup you got to watch? Mine was 87s, you know, it... at Muirfield Village when Ollie did a little jig along the green, and that got me hooked. Which one started it all off for you, mate?
First one I remember is 91. I remember there was lots of excitement in Northern Ireland because David Fearty had made the team and
he was
very close to us, and we sort of knew his family well. So there was a lot of excitement about that. And I remember watching that at Keogh Island, staying up late on the Sunday night, being heartbroken when Bernard Langer missed that putt. And that was a thrilling climax, you know, the war on the shore. So that's the first one I remember, 91 at Keogh Island.
Was it awesome, mate? Awesome. UK?
Wow, see, I'm a little bit younger. The last one I really remember the first one I remember paying attention to in a big way was probably 2006 at the K Club. I was away at university. I think it was my first year at uni. And I didn't have Sky TV, so I couldn't watch it. But I was listening on the radio and watching highlights of it. So that's the first one I really remember properly engaging in, would be 2006.
You're not that much younger than the rest of us at the first.
Also, I was a little bit later to golf. So I started playing golf really when I was about 16. So obviously I'm considerably younger than you both, and then I came into golf.
2006 at the K Club was special, and obviously for Darren Clark, that was an amazing week. My favorite, a really sort of nerdy Ryder Cup fact, which I love trotting out every now and then, is 2006 at the K Club remains the last time that a putt was holed to win the Ryder Cup.
I saw you tweet that, and I loved it. That's a great Ryder Cup fact.
So there hasn't been a pothole to win a Ryder Cup since. There you go.
Marco Simone.
Rasmus Højgaard. Draining a 20-footer on the hill at the 18th. Yeah,
that'll be get down to bookies if you think that's good. I'm good, man. Yeah,
I think I'd like it to be Guido Migliozzi and Marco Simone, I think. That would be
even better shout. Guido has got a great chance of being there. I sort of this summer said Guido might even have a little run at getting a pick on this team. Obviously, it was a bridge too far, but he would be good. We got optimism, though. We did just get smashed, but looking ahead, lots of bright young players. Marco Simone is going to be a great venue for it. Someone's going to step up, and whatever happens, the Ryder Cup will continue to be awesome. Jamie, thank you for coming on and sharing your experiences of your first ever one.
Hello, Jamie.
Thank you for having me. Apologies for Twix interrupting the podcast.
Mate, he can come on any day, mate.
Pet interruptions can only raise the level of the podcast.
I'm going to go and take her for a walk now, get some of that unexpended energy out.
John needs to sleep as well. He's got a bit of unexpended energy. John, you're off to Euro Pro Q School first stage at your gaff Clevedon this afternoon, aren't you?
Yeah, it's just down the road, 10 minutes away. My mate's entered. He's giving it a go. Couple of boys. We haven't got as many as we'd like, but, I mean, we're going up there. The weather looks absolutely mint. It's coming off up the Bristol Channel. It's not a breath of wind, so they're going to have an absolutely million-dollar golf course up there, that's for sure. So I'm looking forward to seeing what the scores are going to be like. The standard's getting big. This is where it all starts to be a Ryder Cup player, actually. You've got to start at the low points, you know, and, you know, the lower stages of the professional ranks. And, you know, I might be walking around with 25 to 30 people up there. One of them might be a future Ryder Cupper. Who knows? So I'm looking forward to going up there and see what I see. You know, but this is where it all starts.
Where it started for Tyrrell Hatton, where Tommy Fleetwood got his first pro win. So you never know. Amy, thank you again. John, thank you. Thank you, of course, to everyone for listening at home, as you always do. This has been the Filthy Lip Out Golf Podcast. You can follow us at Filthy Lip Out on Twitter. But that's all for this week. We'll see you next time.